This is Kelly Crager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Roland Miles. Today is 20 May 2009. I am in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Miles is joining us from his office in Wellsville, New York. I'm interviewing Mr. Miles today in order to gain his reminiscences of his experiences as an aircraft mechanic during Operation Ranch Hand in Vietnam. Mr. Miles, I want to thank you once again for consenting to this interview with me today.
Not a problem, Kelly. I appreciate your opportunity, and I appreciate the fact you're doing this.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. Well, to start this interview, sir, let's get a little biographical information. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Buffalo, New York. I was born on February 7, 1948, about 6 p.m. in the evening.
What were your parents' names?
I have separated families all over the place. Let's see, it's Paul Miles was my dad, and Evelyn, at the time Miles, obviously, was my mom.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what did your family do for a living?
I own an insurance office in both Friendship, New York and Wellsville, New York at this time, independent insurance, and it's general insurance.
Oh, very good, very good. What about your parents? What did they do for a living?
Both are passed away at this time.
Mm-hmm. Growing up, what was their occupation?
My dad was a welder in a local plant most of his life, and my mom did a little bit of everything, but she mostly was a waitress in different restaurants all over the place.
Okay, okay. How would you describe your childhood there in New York?
Kelly, from the time I was 2 to 15, I was raised by my grandmother, and my childhood was very good.
Okay. What sort of things did you do as a child there in terms of just pastimes or school or sports, things like that?
Didn't do much of anything. Being raised by your grandmother, you're a kind of old school type style.
Sure.
And the thing I remember about Graham was not doing things and not, we went to church a lot. I wasn't allowed to go to movies. I wasn't allowed to do certain things. But as I got older, I did play a lot of ball with the kids in the area. You know, in Buffalo, New York, I mean, I live in an area that's not so great now, but back then I could want to run around all night long almost, and she didn't have any fears of that or anything like that, so we had a good time at there.
Very good. What about school? How did school treat you?
School was good up until about the sixth grade, then all of a sudden the subjects started getting a little harder, and even when I came to Friendship, New York as a sophomore in high school, I can't say I struggled, but there were some courses that certainly weren't my favorite. Let's put it that way.
Sure, sure. Well, what sort of courses were your favorites? What did you like the best?
I liked art classes, and I did okay on certain, like, business-type classes is where I did best in. And math, I did very well in math. Didn't do so good in the sciences or the world history-type area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now growing up there in Buffalo,
yes, sir.
How aware were you of larger events, developments for the United States? When did you graduate high school is the first question I should ask you.
Graduated from high school in 1966, was in Friendship, New York when I graduated. I spent the last 3 years there in Friendship. I left Buffalo in 1963, and being raised again by my grandmother, who I loved dearly, and appreciate everything she did for me, you were not tuned in to exactly everything that went on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you just how aware you were of Cold War developments.
You knew what was going on, but that was the extent of it. You just didn't get too, I guess the feeling where it was, it didn't affect us directly, so mm-hmm. We weren't worried about it.
Sure, sure. Well, you leave in 1963, so you leave Buffalo for Friendship in 1963.
Yes, sir.
Of course, in 1963, as well as the Kennedy assassination.
That's right.
As a young man, what was your impression of that? What do you remember?
I remember I was in world history class, and it was on the school PA system, the whole affair, and we all stopped school and didn't do anything for that period of time.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what kind of impact it had on you or your community?
Per se, no, I can't say that, sir, and be very honest with you about it.
Sure, sure. Okay, well, you graduate high school in 1966, and you are somewhat aware, you know, as aware as an 18-year-old could probably be, I would guess,
mm-hmm.
what's going on in the world.
Right.
What about the Vietnam War? This is something the United States is fully vested in by 1966. How aware were you of what was taking place there?
Knew what was going on, didn't know all the details of it. only because at 18 years old in 1966, the draft was still very prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to, my dad had a history of racing on dirt racetracks. He, at 18, he was going to help me build a race car, and my friend found out, whose also name began with M, that him and I were going to get drafted the next month. So in lieu of that, we enlisted in the Air Force instead. So we were somewhat aware of what was going on, but no details of the whole affair.
Sure, sure. What did it mean to you to have this draft looming over your head as a new high school graduate?
Well, it was something that you had to take notice of, that's for sure, and you had to be aware of it. You paid attention very closely to your draft number or where you were being drafted or whatnot. And I don't want to say it made you afraid, but it made you aware of what was going on around you.
Sure.
With the military and stuff like that.
Right. Did the thought of Vietnam enter your mind with the growing American participation in the war? And you are a brand new high school graduate.
At the time, no, sir. When I went to the Air Force, I came out of the Air Force boot camp. I went to tech training. And when I came out of tech training, I called home, and I just told the family I'm going to Vietnam, and I was the only one to have orders to go to Vietnam from that tech school.
Hmm.
But I just knew that's what was going to happen. Whether it was the good Lord working on me or what, or letting me know what was going on, I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say before you were drafted into the Army, you decided to join the Air Force. Can
yes,
you explain to me why, in a little more detail, why you decided to join the Air Force?
Because my friend did. Mm-hmm. He decided to, and we could go in under the buddy system.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through basic training under the buddy system.
Where did you go to basic?
Shepherd, sir.
In Shepherd, okay.
Yes, sir.
In Shepherd.
I had to stop and think about that. I knew it was Lackland, because that's where everyone else goes.
Okay.
So.
Well, what do you remember about boot camp?
It was hot, and I told my friend, and him and I were very athletic, and we played a lot of sports and stuff like that. I said from basic boot camp training, we were going to treat it just like it was a obstacle course type sporting event, and that worked out very well for us.
So in terms of physical training, you guys were in pretty good shape for all
yes,
this.
Sir.
So
yep.
It wasn't the debilitating thing that many people talk about.
No, no, not at all. It wasn't for us anyways.
Was the what about the lifestyle there between the discipline and the hard work and the rules
and regulations?
The discipline
and hard work didn't bother us. The first couple, 3 weeks, I know it was a little, you know, you were right on top, they were right on top of you. But after that, it settled down and you were living your life.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what it amounted to.
I guess it would probably help that you were in good physical condition. And
exactly,
those
yes,
kinds
sir.
Of things. It makes it a whole lot easier,
yep.
I think, mentally on someone when they go in there a little more prepared.
I remember the mile run, just as an example. I had been in all the training for the mile run. I had been finishing first all the time. And when it came time to train, you had to finish so much, so many minutes. And I was first finisher, and my friend was third finisher. So...
Hmm.
We felt we were in pretty good shape.
Right. Well, when boot camp is over, what do you hope to do within the Air Force?
Well, I wanted to go into photography.
Hmm.
That was my goal, and that's what I, at the time, thought I was, no, that's not the right word to use. I thought I was signing up for photography, but I ended up being a mechanic. And the reason I did that, and I understand why, because when I took the aptitude test type thing, I knew what a monkey wrench was, and that was basically because I was out in the garage with my dad a lot.
Sure, sure.
So obviously I was a mechanic.
So out of boot, you became a mechanic. Where do
yes,
you go
sir.
For your advanced training here?
I stayed right there.
You stayed there at,
yes,
at Shepherd?
And I stayed there, and then I went to Florida just for 1 week, 10 days to work on small planes, to learn to work on small planes before going to Vietnam.
Okay, now what kind of training were you receiving here at Shepherd?
What kind of training were we receiving? The training was how to work on prop airplanes,
mm-hmm.
123s, mostly C-47s, things like that. And it was a little bit of general mechanic work, so it was a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm. How well do you think you did in your training?
Did well. did well because I had a lot of interest in it. I was a mechanic head or monkey red head, if you want to call it that, from the word go, and I had a lot of interest in that. So learning anything to do with aircraft was a very interesting thing to me. So I think I did very well in it.
So it sounds like you've made some good decisions for yourself up to this point.
Well,
you were awarded the Army. You're doing well in the Air Force.
Yeah, and the Air Force was good for a couple reasons, and I got more yet to, on that issue. But at this point, I would have to say it was definitely good.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been working on these prop planes. You're working on the 123, the C-47.
Right, yes, sir.
Again, as you were moving through your time in the Air Force, did you have any sort of idea that it would be Vietnam for you?
No, sir. I went straight for Vietnam. Let me think about this for a minute. I was 19 years old when I went to Vietnam, and I went right there right out of tech school, and I came home. So after 2 years of being in the service, I had already served one tour in Vietnam. And, even Vietnam was a job.
Mm-hmm.
You just did your job, and, being away from home wasn't so great, but I wasn't married. I was a single guy, and, you just did your job, and that's all there was to it.
Sure, sure. Well, when you finished with your tech school and you received your orders to go to Vietnam,
yes, sir.
What kind of effect did that have on you, and what kind of effect did it have on your family?
I think, Kelly, to be honest with you, I think the family handled it. I think I handled it pretty well. I think the family kept it to themselves. They didn't let on to too much. My grandmother, who, again, I was raised by, wasn't thrilled, but she accepted it, and I think she accepted it because I was accepting it. So I think that made a lot of difference. My mom and my dad were still alive at that time, and I had a little bit of a relationship with them, more so with my dad than anyone else.
Did they offer you any sort of kinds of advice or anything before you left?
None whatsoever, sir.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, here you are. You're 19 years old.
You
mentioned that I don't want to call it an idyllic life in Buffalo, but it seems to be pretty standard.
Comfortable.
Yeah, comfortable life, for sure.
Yes, sir. Yep.
You mentioned that you didn't pay all that much attention to these greater world events because it didn't affect you that much, very, very common, for sure.
Right.
So to some degree, you're somewhat isolated from these things. Growing
exactly.
up in Buffalo is not a rural area, but upstate New York, northern New York can
yes,
be
sir.
Somewhat rural, obviously.
Yep.
Now you've got orders to go to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and it's, what, 1967 by this point?
It would be 67, yes, sir.
Okay, 1967. In 67, the American involvement is continuing to ramp up.
Mm-hmm.
You have the anti-war movement in the United States is growing. You're beginning to see the war on the news in the news reports,
mm-hmm.
evening in, evening out, becoming much, much more in the public's eye. What were your thoughts about this? I mean, here you are, a young man who is getting ready to leave his normal life, quote-unquote normal life, to go to this international phenomenon and be in this war. What kind of things are going through your head?
At first, it was like almost scary because you just didn't know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
Once I got there, you kind of got a handle on what was going on and stuff. But as far as the war is concerned, you still weren't tuned into it. You knew you were going over there to fight for your country. And that was all that was needed to be said.
Mm-hmm.
That was the important thing. But as far as what you were expecting and stuff like that, you had no idea at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I assume you had some leave time between when you received your orders for Vietnam and when you actually had to report to the West Coast to leave. Is that true?
I did, yes, sir.
What did you do with that time?
Basically, I had a young lady friend who was in college. I had a friend who was home from the Navy. And him and I just kind of hung around together, and then on weekends we went and picked her up, and I spent weekends with her.
Mm-hmm.
And that was basically it. We didn't do a lot, didn't have a lot of money being young kids like we were, not in the military very long, so we didn't have an awful lot of money. So we did the cheap stuff, whatever we could do that didn't cost a lot of money. At the time, going to a movie didn't cost very much money.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, it costs a lot more than that. So.
Yes, indeed.
But that's what we did, basically. Just kind of hung out together, cruised around,
mm-hmm.
Things like that. At the time, my brother was still in high school and was playing soccer, so we went to a lot of his soccer games.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it sounds like you're relaxing a little bit.
Yeah, it's basically what we did. We just relaxed, took it easy.
Sure, sure. Well, when do you move out to the West Coast? Do you remember the month or date?
Now, West Coast for...
For the trip to Vietnam.
Yes, I'm sorry. Forgive me. It would have been... I have to think about this. February... No. I went in February. It's November of 67.
Okay. Now, where do you fly out of?
San Francisco, sir.
San Francisco. So you flew out of Travis, I would assume?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Well, actually, yes, we did. Yes, we did.
Okay. What was that plane like? What was that
it was a Flying Tiger commercial airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And I flew back on a Flying Tiger commercial airplane.
Some kind of closure there, I guess.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
What was the atmosphere like on that plane?
Subdued, mostly. Don't remember a lot about it other than that we just didn't know. No one knew what was going on, per se.
Mm-hmm.
We knew where we were going and what was going on, and we just knew we were doing our job.
Mm-hmm. Did those feelings change as you got closer to your destination?
I can't say per se, no, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone was more relieved to get landed, actually.
Sure, sure.
Be shot at, maybe.
right. Now, was this a direct flight, or you stopped over somewhere for refueling?
As I recall, we did stop someplace like Hawaii for refueling just once, and it was quick over, just in and out real quick.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even travel. But got off the plane, and that was the extent of it.
Sure. Well, where did you fly into in Vietnam? Was it Tan Sanh, Da Nang? Where did you fly into?
Benoit.
In Benoit, okay.
Yes, sir.
Give to me, if you can, your first impressions when you're walking off that plane in Benoit.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember?
Hot and humid, and I did write back to my lady friend, who is my wife now, by the way, that it is a beautiful country. If you get over the war issues, if you can get over that issue, the sculptures of the building and things like that. And I said to her, I remember writing to her and saying, someday I'd like to bring you back to this country to visit it.
Oh, wow.
But I'm not sure I would like to now.
But obviously it made quite an impression on you at the time then.
Well, at the time it was like I'd never seen, of course, at 19 years old, I didn't know anything at all. I'm looking around the buildings and structures and seeing how things were built and how beautiful the country was and stuff like that. But at the time, it looked that way.
Sure, sure. Now, had you been assigned to a specific unit when you were over there, or did you wait until you got to Benoit before you were assigned?
Well, here's the deal, sir. When I got there, no one knew I was coming.
Really?
And they didn't know what to do with me. So what I trained in Florida to work on, I never worked on those planes. They assigned me to the ranch hand. And they just said, go on down to the ranch. So I went down there, and I was part of that crew for the next year.
Now, how long were you there without orders?
I'm going to say maybe an hour.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't like you were wandering around.
No, sir. No, not at all. I was there at the base, and they said, who are you? And I told them, and I showed them my orders, and they said, well, we don't have any record of you coming and where you're going to go. So they went and checked around, and they finally said, take them down to the ranch. So that's where I went.
Did that make any difference to you? Did it mean anything to you?
None whatsoever.
Sure, sure. I would think that it probably wouldn't have. Did you have any idea what ranch hand was?
No, none whatsoever, sir.
Okay, well, now you obviously do. Can you give me what your impression of the overall purpose, mission, scope of Operation Ranch Hand was?
I was very fortunate that I got to... I can say that. I think I was fortunate. I got to travel around with the plane. I was in Benoit, Cameron Bay, Da Nang, stuff like that. So I got to talk to quite a few of the Marines who were fighting at the time, and they couldn't speak highly enough of the ranch and ranch hands and what they did.
Mm-hmm.
They said without that we would be. But as it turns out, maybe that wasn't so good, a herbicide type stuff. But,
sure.
The ranch... We felt we were doing a very good service to our fighting boys,
mm-hmm.
and in support of them.
And of course, it's the defoliation missions over South Vietnam.
Yes, sir.
To help clear some of the jungle and the underbrush.
Yep,
out of the way.
Exactly. And they commented to me they could not fight the Vietnamese if that had not been cleared away.
Mm-hmm. Now, what unit were you assigned to? 67, would that have been the 12th Air Commando Squadron at the time?
That I don't have any idea, sir.
Okay.
Couldn't tell you that.
All right, so you...
At 19 years old, I didn't pay any attention to that type of stuff.
Sure.
Truthfully.
I can completely understand that. So you've been in country for all of an hour.
Yes, sir.
You say you're almost like a tourist looking around at some of the buildings and the...
I was, sir.
Everything that's happening in Benoit, of course, I assume is a very, very busy place at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You've been assigned to the ranch, as you say.
Yes, sir.
Operation Ranch Hand. Now, what do you describe for me? I should ask this first. Describe for me the process by which you go down to the ranch, and you receive your orders there, where you're going to stay, and trying to fit into this unit. What was all that like for you?
They just put me on a truck and took me down there, van-type truck.
Mm-hmm.
Took me down there and presented me at the office, and that's the extent of it. They elected what hut I was going to be in because of availability of a bed. And I fit in very well with the people. The guys there were wonderful guys, and they accepted me very well, and we did a very good job, and I mean, friendship-wise and stuff like that, and we got along very well. Between you and I wished in my mind that I knew enough of them and knew to be able to keep in touch with them, but at this point, I just don't know names, and I can't remember, and I'd like to keep in touch with some of them, but unable to at this time.
Sure, sure. Was there any sort of initial hazing or initiations or anything when you came into the unit?
Never.
Never?
No, sir.
So it sounds like you fit in pretty well then.
I did, yeah. Got along very well with them. I was a motorhead, obviously. I liked cars, and a couple of those guys liked cars as well. So we talked cars a lot and what was going on and hot rods and things like that. So then I had my family send over pictures of Dad and his race car, so I showed the guys that. So we had a lot of things in common, most of the guys.
Well, it certainly sounds like you had quite I don't want to say attachment necessarily, but some very real fondness for these individuals. Who were these guys, and what were they like? What sort of things were they into? Where were they from? Those kinds of things.
I wish I could remember some of that. I really do, Kelly, but I just can't, and it just irritates me to no end. I have been, I don't know, you have it on record there, I've been at the health study for the 20 years, hoping I would run into some of those guys, and I never did,
right. Unfortunately.
But mostly what I remember of them is that they were 3 months ahead of me, so they left 3 months before I did, and then I was the loner from that point, the last 3 months. Not really loner, it was just different. Most of them were motorheads, most of them liked cars a lot. And we communicated that avenue an awful lot. And we communicated on the mechanical work of the aircraft as well.
Mm-hmm. So did you go to work that first day?
No, sir, I did not. I'd say the next day.
Mm-hmm. What other sort of things did you do on that first day? If you can remember, of course.
Just get settled in, get my bed made, and get my locker filled up with stuff. And then went to the commissary to obtain my daily need things.
Right.
So that was the extent of it.
Were these guys you met on your first day or early in your tour, were they offering you any sort of advice? Were they offering you any sort of warnings? Did you get a general feeling of their opinion of their service there?
No, I never did. The only thing advice they let me know is if the siren goes off in the middle of the night, you roll out and head for that bunker fast as you can get there.
Okay.
Because they had incoming coming in.
Sure.
And it was true. So we all did the same thing at that particular time. So they didn't offer any advice, negative or positive, either one. But we just seemed to get along well.
Well, can you describe Benoit for me in 1967 from your impressions, what you remember?
Being a 19-year-old kid, I never went off base. I stayed right to that hut. Between the hut, the commissary in the kitchen, and down on the ranch, that was my life.
For an entire year, that was your life?
Well, almost, except the fact I traveled. I never went off that Benoit base until I traveled with the airplane.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very
Cameron
good.
And Da Nang.
Okay, what would you be doing with the, you say you're a motorhead, were you working just on the engines or other parts of the plane? What was your daily
routine? Basically the whole airplane.
Okay.
The elevators, the flaps, the generators, the engine, the throttles, whatever it happened to be. We worked on it. We called specialists, and then quite often the specialists, but we had to be there with the plane. Somebody had to be there with the plane while the specialist was working on it.
Mm-hmm.
So basically we worked on the whole airplane.
Right, right.
It wasn't specialized to one area.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got these, or I was going to assume they were 123s. Were you working on the 123?
I was, exactly.
Okay. 123s.
Yes, sir.
What sort of condition did you find these C-123s in as you were working on them? They're flying pretty low. They're flying very slow.
Yep. Quite frankly, I felt they were in very good condition considering what they went through.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were extremely, extremely good condition, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. Now, you found yourself a niche. You found yourself an organization or a unit where you're fitting in pretty well. You've got guys who have common interest with you. It sounds like you're doing something that you really, really enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things would you do when you weren't on duty? You mentioned that it was kind of like a job. What sort of things were you doing to pass your time when that job was over for the day?
At night, we would just sit around, play cards, darts. I would go to the commissary, but I also would go over to, they had a music library,
mm-hmm.
and you could download music and stuff like that, but I wasn't into much music at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of sat back and relaxed. Basically, we did a lot of card playing, mm-hmm. to be honest with you.
Sure, sure.
Just kind of funning with the guys.
Did you ever have any opportunity to write letters home or to make
all
tapes
the time.
At home?
Yep, was writing letters all the time. I wrote to the young lady friend almost every day,
okay.
and I would write to my mother and grandmother and stepmother, I would say, at least once a week.
What sort of things were you putting in your letters to them?
Basically just told them what was going on, Kelly. If we got incoming coming in one night or two nights out of the week or something like that, or I wouldn't be able to drop you a note because we're flying up north.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. Just nothing earth-shattering, just typical conversation.
Right.
With a lady friend and mother, if you understand what I mean.
I understand. they would be somewhat different letters, distinctly
yes,
different letters.
Yes, absolutely they were.
I would hope so.
No doubt.
Well, you mentioned about having rounds coming in, maybe being mortared or rocketed.
Yes, sir.
Can you describe some of these for me, some of these events?
The siren would go off in the middle of the night, and we would head for the bunker, and we would hear the explosion, them exploding around us. Basically, from what I understand and can remember, is they were trying to target the flight line, the airplanes, and they were trying to hit them. But we weren't that far off the flight line in our huts, and a lot of things came over that way.
Sure. Yeah. But how often would you say that you were rocketed or mortared?
I am going to say initially it probably was twice a week.
Twice a week, that often?
Yes, sir. And then I would say, and quite frankly, sometimes that was meant to be as much as a nuisance
mm-hmm.
to you in the middle of the night as it was meant to be anything else.
Sure.
But then toward the end of my tour, I would say almost nil.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny.
Huh. But, do you remember your first experience with one of these attacks?
No, sir, I don't.
Okay.
Per se.
All right. That's perfectly fine. What other sort of things would you do when you weren't busy being rocketed and writing these letters? You're talking about
playing. We played hearts a lot.
Playing a lot of cards.
Yeah, we played a lot of hearts. We played a lot of darts. If we weren't doing that, that's basically all we were doing, listening to music and talking and stuff like that. We didn't really do much else.
Mm-hmm.
The guys, the rest of them, when town was still open, would go downtown every once in a while, but I never left the base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly, as dangerous as Benoit could be, the town could probably be a little more dangerous.
Well, and I was young enough, I was a little naive, and I was a little stupid and, a little scared maybe
mm-hmm.
of what was going on down there that I wasn't sure about.
Sure.
And I wasn't raised to wander around like that anyway, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you and your friends ever pass the time by discussing the war, the progress of the war, or anything like that?
No, the only thing that I do remember about the war was that you could hear it during the day. Sometimes you heard the B-52s bombing, and you kept thinking to yourself, or we may have discussed it, how we could go in there and clean this up if we really wanted to quickly, but never did. That was the extent of it, of what I recall of the conversations, but it didn't last very long.
Sure. So, well, you say something that was very, very common among Vietnam War veterans, is that if they had let us do what we were designed to do, we'd have done that.
And I think that's it. I think we were frustrated with everything that from that standpoint. We knew what we were there to do, and we did our job. But, you know, it was still frustrating from the standpoint that if they let you do your job, you could have cleaned it up a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly a very common refrain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the issues that is oftentimes brought up, especially among rear elements such as yours, was things going on the base, in the camps, when not on duty, or even on duty in some cases. One of the issues is, of course, racial issues, racial discrimination or racial tensions. Did you experience any of that? Did you witness any of that while you were there in Benoit?
Never. We had several in our barracks, bunks, our hut, as we called it, and we extremely good, got along very well with them. Never was a problem whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I never experienced it, and I don't believe, I can't tell you there was anything that went on the ranch itself with that experience.
Mm-hmm. Something else that has become associated with the Vietnam War, and unfortunately, because it is so much of it is myth, but part of it is true as well, is the extent of drug use during the Vietnam War. Did you witness anything in this area?
Didn't actually witness the usages of it, but there was one party who was on night shift. And every morning he would come in, and we always kidded that he was already stoned.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know for a fact. We didn't know what he was on, and we never asked.
Okay. So you're...
That was the only experience we had. That's why I say I think we had a pretty good hut, because nobody bothered anyone, and we didn't have any of that problem in ours.
Mm-hmm. So you say someone was working the night shift, so you worked at least two shifts then.
He did. He was one of the few. There wasn't very many that were on the night shift, but he was one of the few.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what about things like R&R or USO?
Had a chance to go on R&R, but never did because I just didn't have the money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't smart enough to save the money to get out of country.
Is that right?
Yeah. So.
What were you doing with the money?
Nothing. I just didn't get paid a lot. I sent as much home as I could.
Sure.
But, you know, you bought your monthly deals, you bought some books to read, and other than that, some letter material, and other than that, you didn't have much else.
Mm-hmm.
So,
during your daily routine there, working on the planes, now obviously you were a mechanic, and this would not necessarily have affected you, but was there any contact, whether casual contact or prolonged contact with any of the agents, any of the defoliants?
No, sir. Yes. I'm sorry. Forgive me. The defoliants, yes. We handled that every single day.
Mm-hmm. You did?
By hand.
Okay. Now, were you responsible for loading it up, for filling
yes.
the tanks?
Yep, for mostly loading it. Quite often they would come back and they say, okay, we need so many thousand gallons of Agent Yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Or, and then we'd fill up the tank with that and be ready to fly the next day with it or something, or Agent Orange or something like that. And, to fill it up, the plane was backed up to a gas tank type thing, and you put your hose in the tank, and you put your head over it, and you just filled it out to where it needed to be.
Mm-hmm. Was there any sort of precautions that you would take handling this stuff?
Basically, none that I could remember.
Uh-huh.
I think the feeling back then was there was no need to to have any precautions done.
Sure. And that stands to reason, though,
yep.
the history of it, for sure. I believe they were what? I think the C-123 had two 500-gallon tanks or something like
That's correct. Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, you would be on duty. You would do what was necessary, whether it's repairing the plane, maintaining the plane.
Right.
If necessary,
servicing
you'd fill
it.
Up the tank. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Then they would go out on a mission.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How long would they be gone before they came back in?
It depended. They could be 20 minutes. They could be 45. It could be an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And the crew would let you know when they would be expected to be back. it was good. They were good about that.
Mm-hmm.
So it all depended, and it depended on the assignment, where they had to fly to, how long it would take to get there, and how long it would take to get back.
Mm-hmm. So say they go out, and they spray both tanks empty, and they come back in.
Mm-hmm.
Would they be likely to go out on another mission? Would you be ready to?
We have had to. We used to have more than one mission in a day. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often, after no more than two, they would run reservice refuel for the following day.
Mm-hmm. So you could work a full day on these two missions, depending on the missions.
Yes, sir.
Or maybe considerably less, or occasionally maybe even more, I would assume.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. There was times when you had to work all night.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly you didn't do any work. You just had to be there with the plane.
Right, right. Work when the plane was there and then be ready for it when it got back.
Exactly. Yep, sure. You got that right. And sometimes we just stood around and waited in the van until it was time for the plane to come back. And when we saw them flying in, then we knew it was time to get out and take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now when did you arrive in country again? Was it November of 67, I believe?
Yes, sir.
Okay, November of 1967. Obviously, at the end of
January... Now, wait. Let me, Kelly, forgive me. That was August of 67.
August of 67. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay,
forgive
me.
I misspoke to you.
No, that's no problem at all. No problem at all, believe me. Now, by the time that 1968 rolls around, you've
mm-hmm.
been involved in this. I would assume you know your business, you know your job. I don't want to call it comfortable because it would be very, very difficult to use.
Well, you do get comfortable in your job and what you're doing and what's going on.
In January of 1968, of course, the Tet Offensive
yes, sir.
Kicks off.
Yes, sir.
What happened at Benoit and what happened to you?
Well, at the time the Tet Offensive happened, fortunate or whatever, however you want to put it, I was doing a lot of flying at the time as a crew member, ground crew. So we were actually, when it hit Benoit, we were in Cameron. When
okay.
the Tet Offensive moved to Cameron, we moved up to Da Nang, and then from Da Nang back to Benoit. So we weren't really directly. The only thing is, when we got back to Benoit, I remember them issuing us guns and saying, if anyone crosses that fence, you shoot them first and then worry about who they are.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't really directly in, and that's when they shut down all the towns.
Mm-hmm.
The guys couldn't go off base any longer.
Okay, so you were not one step ahead of it, obviously, but you were moving around from different places.
We were moving around, not on purpose. It was just coincidental
sure.
that that's the way our agenda
mm-hmm.
Figured out anyways. Our orders were to be here, be there, be there. And it was just coincidental that we were, coincidental with the good Lord looking after us. I don't know which.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Maybe a combination of things.
Yep.
Well, what did you see about the offensive, and what did you hear about it taking place?
Absolutely nothing. Saw absolutely nothing other than the fact of we heard that the Viet Cong were trying to overrun everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the extent of what we heard, what I remember us hearing.
Now, did this come as some sort of shock to you or surprise to you?
It did in a way, because everything had been so copacetic, per se,
mm-hmm.
so casual and everything, so all along. And then all of a sudden this thing, and it's like, well, where did this come from?
Mm-hmm.
That type of attitude, you know, and things had been so well up until that point.
The Tet Offensive, of course, is oftentimes seen as this great watershed for the American participation in the war for a variety of different reasons.
Kelly, have you got half a second?
Yeah, sure.
Just go ahead.
Go ahead and pick back up then.
All right.
I was asking you about the Tet Offensive.
Yes, sir.
Again, this massive change for a lot of people in the way they viewed the war. They've been...
And it was a change for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say it's a change. Let me ask you, why was it a change, and what was your perception?
Well, everyone looked at it differently. I mean, I just looked at it as, you know, part of the situation we were doing over there. But everybody else seemed to think that was the, how do I word it? They couldn't go downtown anymore, and that was a terrible thing for any of them, for a lot of them. You know, I think that was their escape, getting off the base a little bit,
mm-hmm.
in their way of going and getting away. But people just looked at it differently after that. And they looked at the war a little differently, and they looked at the Vietnamese a little differently and stuff like that. So,
Now, in the United States, of course, the media coverage of the Tet Offensive was it wasn't completely accurate, is certainly one way to put that.
Mm-hmm.
That it was portrayed as being, or it was certainly interpreted as being a loss for a variety of reasons for the United States, when in fact, of course, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong suffered severe, suffered a very serious defeat here. What were you receiving in terms of media coverage from the United States about this?
Basically, as far as I can remember, and again, being 19 years old, I could have cared less, but I don't remember ever hearing anything. Mostly anything I heard was from directly there or directly with my family, you know, through letters and stuff like that, but nothing at all.
What was your family's take on this?
They didn't have any, that I recall. Nothing at all, sir.
Okay. Well, could you, other than, you know, not being able to go into town and limiting contact with some of the locals, how did the offensive, how did it affect you? How did it affect daily life?
Just, except you had to carry guns around. Even on the flight line, you had to carry a gun, and you had to be aware of who was coming and going. And the Vietnamese who used to work on the base were not allowed to come on the base any longer. And they did put a stop to any of that stuff.
What did you think about that? What did you think about the Vietnamese in general, and what did you think about this prohibition of being able to work with them?
At the time, you didn't give much thought to the Vietnamese. Then you started looking at them like, well, is that really one of them or not? You know, that type of thing. So
sure.
We just didn't have any idea at the time.
So the Vietnamese,
you looked at them just a little bit more suspiciously. Even when they first started coming back onto base, you looked at them like, okay, I'm going to watch what I'm doing now. So
that was with the Vietnamese civilians with whom you were working.
Yes, sir. Yes, that's exactly right.
What was your impression of the of Vietnamese military?
Military.
The Arvid
didn't
military.
Have an awful lot to do with them. I know they were there, but didn't have an awful lot of connection to them, per se.
Sure.
But as far as they were very adequate and very competent people, as far as what I could understand.
Okay, very good.
Yep.
Now, you came into the country in August of 67, and we've got us through a January and February of 1968. You mentioned that you had started to fly, that you were on board some of these missions, moving around. What led to that?
Basically, they needed mechanics to go with the planes, so when we would change locations, when we started flying, I switched over to the Mosquito Bird, the Patches, and I was that plane. It was still the ranch hand, the same outfit and everything. It just was a little different bird, and that plane moved around a lot, and I got to fly with that plane.
And what kind of plane was this?
It's also 127.
Also
123. Forgive me.
Okay. So you're flying, trying to cut down on insects, mosquitoes.
Yep. Exactly.
Like that.
Yep.
Okay. Also, I would think that the troops would be very appreciative.
Oh yeah, very much so. They were.
Now you've had the opportunity to move from place to place and to see different things and to speak with different people. What sort of impressions were you getting about the war, the conduct, and the progress of the war as you moved about from place to place?
The impression of the war itself was no different any place. Da Nang was much more intense. Cameron was the other way around. It was much more relaxed. We actually got on the bus and went downtown in Cameron, and you saw lots of Vietnamese all over the place. You just kind of wondered then about it and held your breath and stuff like that.
Right. But that wasn't the case in Da Nang. Can you explain
No, sir.
Why?
No, Da Nang was definitely off limits. Da Nang was definitely very much more intense. We weren't there very long. I don't think the crew liked to be there very long.
Can you explain why?
Because it was so intense, and you just didn't know what was going on or what was coming next or what was happening. And when they came in to fly in on the planes, they had to come in very steep in the beginning and land quickly, because or else they would get shot at on the end of the base,
sure.
End of the runway.
Now, during any of your time on the on these missions, was your plane ever fired upon?
None that I was ever in, no, sir. And we took precautionary with it. We wore the proper flight vests and stuff like that, and but our plane never was shot. I was never on the plane when it was shot at.
Regardless of that, were you cognizant of the fact that here I am on this very slow-moving plane, mm-hmm. flying pretty low, and it could be susceptible to even small arms fire, let
small
alone
arm
surface,
fire,
to
that's
air,
right.
Surface to air missiles, things like that. Did it give you any pause? Did it bother you at all that this was the case?
Well, you held your breath mm-hmm. when you flew. I mean, you knew what you were doing and what you were getting into. It's just something you had to absorb. A lot of the pilot and co-pilot and the navigators and stuff, they sat on what was perceived as bulletproof, not cushions, but underneath the cushions, pads, mm-hmm. like let's say.
Right.
So you had to be prepared for that type of stuff.
Sure.
But we never took on, and when we flew, we usually flew a little bit higher than that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but.
Oftentimes in crisis situations or in very uncomfortable situations, people will embrace a type of humor, a black humor or a gallows humor or something like that. Did you witness any of that in terms of what people were saying or how they approached things
No, nothing that I could say, nothing I could put my finger on, no sir.
Okay, very good. How many of these missions do you estimate that you flew on?
North, I would say I went on, I would say 8 of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this considered a choice mission or something that no one really else cared about?
No, if you were in that plane, our whole outfit would go.
Oh, okay.
Yep, you didn't have much choice, those were the orders.
Okay, I gotcha.
Very good.
Okay,
now Kelly, let me ask you this. How much longer?
However much time you have today.
I would probably like to call it an end right now.
That's not a problem. We'll
and
do
I
that
apologize
right now.
For that.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Roland Miles. Today is 27 May, 2009. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Miles is joining us again from his office in Wellsville, New York. Okay, Mr. Miles, when we left off last time, we had captured your impressions of the Tet Offensive and the aftermath of that.
Yes, sir.
Of course, in January and February of 1968. Now, you arrived in country in August of 1967, so you have about 6-7 more months of time in country before it's time for you to leave.
That's correct. Yes, sir.
How closely were you watching that clock ticking away? Were you following the calendar very closely?
Didn't follow it until the last 100 days. And the only reason on 100 days is because it was easy when you sent a letter to your lady friend, you put the 100 days or 99 days, and she would return her letter and put the dates on there too. So that's the only reason I remember following it, because we both kept track of it through our letters.
Mm-hmm. I've heard some people say that they kept track from day one, from 364 on down, and others would wait until the 100 days or
exactly.
until a month away, because no. it helped them deal with it one way or another. I
exactly.
guess,
and you know, in 100 days, as I mentioned to you, I was 3 months off on those other guys, my mm-hmm. friends. They had left about 90 days, so I had about 90 days left when they left. And that was kind of my thing,
mm-hmm.
if you will.
Sure.
I just kind of downgraded from there and went with them and stuff like that. So.
Well, the other guys left, and you had 90 days left in country.
Yes, sir.
Their replacements came in.
Mm-hmm.
What role did you play within your unit as the older guy, as the more experienced guy?
Nothing per se, because I was still only 19 years old,
mm-hmm.
so most of those guys coming in were older than me. They would ask me questions and things like that, but as far as we never got, of course, I only had the 3 months left.
Mm-hmm.
We never got as close to them as we did the guys that left.
Sure. Do you know why that would be?
No, I don't really know why. I have no real handle, and I have no real feelings toward that, other than the fact is that maybe they were closer with each other than I was. But.
Mm-hmm. And what is your rank at this time, say, early 1960s?
It would be E3.
You're E3 at the time?
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good. And you're still going out on these missions occasionally? You're flying?
Yes, sir. Yep, we did right up to the end.
Okay, right up to the end.
Yes, sir.
All right, now, you say that it's 100 days before you start to, before you start the countdown, before you start that, that short timer's calendar.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things would you think of when you were thinking of, I'm going to get out of Vietnam at such and such date? What sort of things were going through your mind about what you wanted to do when you got home?
Basically, how to get home. Home is in the country. Mm-hmm. And then knowing we were going into San Francisco and I had to go clear to Buffalo, how I was going to get from Buffalo, from San Francisco to Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, when I was going to meet up with the lady friend and stuff like that.
Sure, sure. Did you give any thoughts to what sort of career you might have been looking forward to, going back to school or anything like
that? No, sir. The problem with that, Kelly, is that I hadn't started thinking about that yet. I had 2 more years to go in the service, so mm-hmm. I was more concerned of where I was going and how far, quite frankly, how far away I was from home.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes perfect sense, of course.
Yep.
Okay, well, as you're winding down your time there, mm-hmm. do you find yourself, obviously you were not a combat veteran, but you were in country.
Yes, sir.
You were going out on these missions, so you were certainly susceptible to enemy fire and
mm-hmm.
things like that. Did you find yourself becoming more cautious, less cautious? How did you approach your time there and the way you dealt with your daily routine?
I did not become anything more cautious or more cautious or less cautious.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, stayed pretty well consistent and just stayed that way. I was very fortunate, and if I may say this without sounding too whatever, I believed in God, and I believed he was taking care of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you've heard that, or you haven't heard it, I don't know. You know, that's just the feeling I had,
mm-hmm.
that comfort feeling, I guess. And things were going to be whatever it was.
Right.
That was my feeling.
Okay. Now, 1968, of course, is a very turbulent year in the,
yes, sir.
For the United States. And in the United States, you had the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.
Exactly.
In April, then the assassination of Bobby Kennedy in the summer of 1968, and everything else that is taking place here. The anti-war movement is growing more and more vociferous. What, if anything, were you hearing about what was going on in the United States, this country that you were going to go back to?
I actually heard nothing per se. The only thing I heard from was my brother,
mm-hmm.
who was only a year younger than I was. And he kept saying, he's not going to war. I'll go to Canada first.
Your brother was saying that.
Yes. But, you know, whether he would or not, that was the next question.
Sure. Well, what was your opinion of this? How did that strike you? There you were doing your duty.
Nothing. None whatsoever. It didn't have any effect on me whatsoever.
Okay.
My feeling was, and I was close to my brother, and I still am close to my brother, but he had to, you know, deal with his own actions. So, you know, I just didn't have any feeling whatsoever.
Now, did that extend to other people who were avoiding the draft, who were going to go
no,
to Canada?
No, I don't think so. Nobody ever, and I communicated with several of them, but I don't recall that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you get a lot of that. Okay. I don't recall that.
Sure, yeah. These things happened a long time ago.
Yes, sir.
No doubt about that.
I said that to my wife. I was telling her what some of the questions she asked. She said, my gosh, that was 40-some years ago. They realize that. So.
No, this has been terrific. Okay, well, we're winding down your clock.
Yes, sir.
It's coming down to you've hit your date. Here it is, August of 1968.
Mm-hmm.
You've done your tour in Vietnam.
Yes,
sir.
You've
worked on these planes. You've flown on some of these missions.
Yep.
You've served your time in the Air Force. You're getting ready to go back to the U.S. Describe for me the process by which you processed out of Vietnam and came home.
The only thing I remember was my first sergeant coming to me the day before I flew out and said, I can still make it happen, and I will almost guarantee you another stripe if you stay, another 6 months.
Wow.
And I says, I can guarantee it'll happen still. Other than that, I don't remember a lot other than the flight back, a little bit of that, the loneliness. Even though the plane was completely full, you still had that feeling, that loneliness, and I thought the plane would erupt when it landed, and there was dead silence on the plane.
Huh, that's very interesting. That's certainly not the common thing that I hear.
No, I was shocked at all this. I was not prepared for any of that. I was prepared for much more jovial feelings and jovial celebration when you landed and stuff like that. But to me, there was dead silence on the plane.
What do you think accounts for that?
I don't know. The comfort factor of being home, maybe? I just don't know. I was just shocked at that whole thing. So I was really surprised at it.
Yeah.
And it could be just the fact that everyone was happy to be home.
And tired.
Yeah, and that too. We were all that. And then I had to go cross country, yeah.
And you had no intention of staying in the Air Force for another 6 months, even if it meant another stripe.
In Vietnam, mm-hmm. I seriously thought about it. They offered you R&R, as you mentioned just last time we talked. But again, I didn't have the money to R&R, mm-hmm. so it didn't matter anything. I'd love to have flown the young lady friend over to Australia or someplace like that, but I couldn't afford to send myself, let alone her.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I probably would have to say I didn't really give it any serious thought.
Sure, sure.
More thought about staying in after 4 years than then.
But, well, I think that would stand to reason because you would be home, hopefully safe, and not doing another tour in Vietnam.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, now you flew into San Francisco.
Yes, sir.
San Francisco, of course, was a hotbed of anti-war activism.
Yep.
We hear stories of returning servicemen coming back through San Francisco and receiving a very, very unwelcome welcome, a very mm-hmm. rude mm-hmm. reception that they received mm-hmm. there. Was this the case for you?
None whatsoever.
What was it like in San Francisco?
And I think part of it was, Kelly, is that we arrived at night
mm-hmm.
and it was dark and there was nothing that went on. Mm-hmm. There was nothing that happened. I called home. I went and bought an airplane ticket at the airport. I called home, told him when I'd be home, and we went from there.
Okay, so you left that night or the next morning?
Well, actually, it had to be the next day because it was light when I left, and I arrived home at supper time.
Mm-hmm.
I just called my grandmother and told her what I wanted for supper.
You
and then I got there, and I was so excited that I couldn't eat.
What was it like when your grandmother heard your voice?
Oh, she was ecstatic. I just know that for a fact. She's long gone now, but she's never repeated any. I'm sure that the family never repeats anything on purpose, but I know she was a little ecstatic when I was home.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, what was your reaction?
And I mean, she's the one that raised me for so many years. So.
Sure.
So, but I'm sorry.
What was your reaction when you heard her voice?
I was more excited when I heard the lady friend voice. If you understand what I mean. We got married, let's see, that would have been a year and a half, so 6 months later we were married, and 40-some years later we're still married.
Oh, that's terrific.
So it's okay.
Terrific. Well,
Thank you.
For me your homecoming, when you met your grandmother.
She met me at the airport.
Okay.
And my grandmother and step-grandfather, and they were the only ones there, and she had cooked exactly what I asked for.
Which was what?
You ready?
Yep.
Sauerkraut and pork.
Oh, that sounds terrific.
Oh, and the way she fixed it was always awesome. And then, because that was something I hadn't had for a whole year.
Mm-hmm.
And now it had the chance, and she went out and got a pork and sauerkraut and cooked it all up, and I couldn't eat it. I felt so bad. She didn't care.
Why couldn't you eat it?
Just nerves, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and sauerkraut's not the finest thing to eat. You know that.
Right, of course.
You know, I mean, as we got older, as we get older, it's even worse. So, but anyways, the excitement factor was definitely there. I was home. I was happy. And I knew I'd see the lady friend probably the next day.
Mm-hmm. And I assume you did then?
Actually, it was 2 days later.
Okay.
She was still in college. She had to stay there because she was having exams on that Friday, so I couldn't pick her up till Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now you've made it home successfully. You still have, 2 years left?
Yes, sir.
In your hitch?
Yep.
But you're home?
Yes, sir.
What had anything started to creep into your mind at this point yet about a future, about a career, or anything like that?
No, because I was stupid and I was smutting by the love life, I guess you might say, what her and I were going to do. And as it turns out, it was either get serious or get married. So we got married instead.
Right, Right.
She got done with her first year of school, and that was the end of that.
And that was
first year of college, I should say.
And that was 6 months after you got back?
That's correct, yes, sir.
Okay. And where did you settle down? Did you settle down in the Buffalo area?
No, sir. We went to, at that point, then we were stationed at Otis Air Force Base, and I got an apartment just before we were married. And after being married, we went back up there. And I spent, let me think here for a minute. I was there almost 2 years, so I was there with her for about, because I came back with 2 years and 6 months to go, and I left, yes, and I, so it was about a year and a half her and I spent up there together.
Mm-hmm. Did you keep up with the progress of the war after you had gotten back?
Just to the degree of my outfit.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to keep track of what was going on, what was happening, and stuff like that. And, you know, just to know what was happening. And then when they settled the war, they said they were closing the war out. That took a great interest in, you took a great interest in that.
What sort of things were you paying attention to? We're talking about the peace talks, 1972.
That the peace talks and how they were going to settle it, how they were going to get the people out of there, and the whole thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
As much the peace situation as anything at the time.
Right. Did you also follow, and you may not have had any choice but to be aware of this, the continuing anti-war movement in the U.S.?
To a degree, a little bit, but not a huge amount.
Mm-hmm.
I figured, you know, I did my part, and if that's the way they wanted to be, then they could be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, you know, they're up to their own problems.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, as American participation is winding down, and the South Vietnamese participation is, of course, going to ramp up correspondingly,
mm-hmm.
We have issues with which we have to deal. One of the major issues is bringing the POWs home. Another issue is scaling back American participation, bringing troops home.
Exactly.
And hoping that this sort of thing holds. Obviously, it doesn't. In April of 75, of course, Saigon falls to the communist forces,
mm-hmm.
and for all intents and purposes, the war is over. What, if anything, do you remember about the fall of Saigon?
Quite frankly, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't pay too much attention to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
And no particular reason, and there was no nothing, you know, there was no reason why I didn't. I just didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, which I apologize to you for.
You certainly don't have to apologize to me. You had done your time there, and life was getting in the way. I think that's perfect.
Well,
okay.
I think that was it, and let me think about this for a minute. That would have been after being married 6 months later, she got pregnant, and we had our first child. So, you know, there was other things that we were thinking about at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And being home, I didn't have much to think about with Vietnam
mm-hmm.
until my 4 years was up.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question pertaining to your particular service in Vietnam with
mm-hmm.
Ranch Hand. And that is the health study that
yes,
was taking place, studying the long-term results of the chemical agents used in Operation Ranch.
Correct.
You mentioned before that you were a participant in the study. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, I was.
Okay. Let me just ask you straight out, how has been your health?
My health has been, in my opinion, excellent.
Excellent.
Up until the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more my own, nothing to do with Agent Orange at all, my knees and things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that type of thing. So no big deal there.
So would it be fair to say that you don't believe that Agent Orange, any sort of Agent Orange-related illnesses or effects have affected you?
None.
None whatsoever?
None whatsoever.
So you loaded this stuff
yes, sir.
When necessary for a year?
Every day.
Every day for a year?
Yes, sir.
And handled it firsthand?
Yes, sir.
I would assume that there's spillage. I would assume you're breathing fumes.
Oh,
and
walking in it. I was telling somebody, we walked in it. Our boots were soaked in it. We sprayed that stuff around our huts just to keep the weeds down,
mm-hmm.
and then we slept around it. You know what I mean? So,
right.
I mean, that's what I don't understand. I mean, and I understand what people are saying, that they were affected by this stuff, but here we were. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I handled the stuff firsthand and still didn't have any effects from it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, let me follow up on that and ask you to provide a little more detail.
Certainly.
It's Agent Orange, of course, is one of those things that comes out of one of the lasting legacies of the war. the dioxins are proven to be obviously very, very hazardous and carcinogens, that people who have been in country, they are firmly convinced, and there's a lot of controversial studies, but studies nonetheless that say that exposure to Agent Orange, especially prolonged exposure to Agent Orange, caused these kinds of illnesses and these kinds of issues, health mm-hmm. issues. What is your feeling about that?
I am not one to point a finger and say you're wrong, but on the other hand, my experience is none of us seem to get it. I don't know about my friends when they left, but I certainly didn't seem to have any effects on it. I don't feel as I did. Maybe I'm wrong, but in my mind, it's not there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said earlier in the interview, our last session, that you didn't keep up with the guys in your unit as much as you'd have liked to have.
That's correct.
And I would assume that you're still not running into these guys as you go to these health studies.
No, I did not. I ran into one person in the 20 years I've been going to the health studies. I ran into one person. He recognized me, and I recognized him. But it was somebody I knew him, but I wasn't close to him.
Mm-hmm.
So, but other than that, there's been nobody.
Okay, now this is, I'm asking you to speculate, so it's not really fair, but I do think that getting your impression of this would be useful.
Yes, sir.
What is your impression of the overall, the health study itself? Do you get the impression that other people who were exposed to these chemicals as much as you were, that they were affected more than you, they were not affected as much as you, that there was no effects whatsoever? What is your impression of that?
My impression of the health study was excellent. It was an excellent, well-done, well-run situation. And my feeling is, and my perception is, that some people had more problems than I did. Absolutely. Was it related to Agent Orange? I can't tell you that, my friend.
Sure.
You know, I just don't know. My feeling is, you know, who am I to point a finger at somebody and say, till you walk in their sandals, I guess you don't do that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I guess, what my grandmother taught me always. So.
Right.
Don't judge what they're saying.
Because each circumstance is certainly different.
Yes, it is different.
Body is different.
It is, and each body is different. Each person handles things like that differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I don't know, in each instance, I mean, I feel I'm extremely healthy. So maybe that had something to do with it. I was just a young whippersnot that didn't know any different back in those days. It's just hard to say.
Sure.
You know, stuff like that. So.
Well, tell me. And this is kind of a large question, and feel free to answer it in whatever way you like, but can you tell me how your experience in the Vietnam War has most affected your life?
I have to think about that a minute, Kelly.
That's okay. Take your time.
How Vietnam... Well, in a way, and it doesn't sound like it by some of the remarks I've made to you, but in a way, it makes you aware of what is going on around you a little bit more, and also what the government is doing about certain things and how they're handling it. I mean, I watch that stuff a little bit closer now.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and if I may say this without sounding too bad, when your kids were the right age where you might go to war with them, you watched it real close. Mm-hmm. Now that they're older, and you realize they probably would not have to do that stuff. It's not as important a deal right now. But as far as what Vietnam did, it certainly made me grow up. I was a 19-year-old young snot-nosed kid when I went over. I was 19 years old, basically a 19-year-old that had grown up when I came back. So even the next-door neighbor said that about me, that you're a lot older, a lot more grown up now.
In what ways? Could you describe that?
Just more, instead of juvenile acting, more adult acting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think funny or not funny, I don't know, he pulled the hair on my chest and said, and you got hair on your chest now. I remember specifically him doing that.
Well, this question is similar to the last,
mm-hmm.
but it is different. And
yes, sir.
Depending on how you look at it, what could you say you learn the most about yourself as a result of your experiences there?
At the time of getting along by yourself, basically, without your family around you and without your loved ones there, I survived a year without them. I'm not sure, honestly, I'm not sure I could do that without my wife now. She was not my wife at the time. I think that would be difficult to do. I survived a year. Now I have children, I have grandchildren, and I look at them and I said, I don't want to be away from them for a whole year. So I feel for the guys that were married at the time. I'm awful glad I was not. And I didn't do anything bad, don't misunderstand me, but I'm just glad that I didn't have to put up with that.
Sure.
In my own mind, I guess. I guess you just learn to survive and move on.
What about, in be as general or specific as you would like here, but what about the, what is your opinion, when you look back on it, America's role in Vietnam, the Vietnam War for the United States, what does that mean to you?
My opinion at the time, and probably still at the time, it was hard for me to understand how they function, because I think, in my mind, it could have been ended very easily, very quickly. And they allowed it to continue and go on and on and on and on. And you sat there wasting a year of your life thinking that to yourself. Why don't they just get this over with and send us home?
Mm-hmm.
That type of thing. So I think I mentioned that last time to you, Kelly, that that was one of the things that we all wondered why this was carrying on the way it did.
Right.
So.
Well, what do you think went wrong?
At this point, at that time, I had no idea. At this time, I believe as economics and the economics of trying to keep the world going in the United States, if you may. And I'm not sure it was wrong, but I also understand there was, 53,000 or 58,000 who lost their lives because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you wonder, was that worth it? I don't know. I who am I to say? It might have been. It might not have been.
Well, we tend to dwell on the negative and the what went wrong in Vietnam kind of
right.
questions. But do you think there was anything that went right as a result of U.S. participation there? Do you see any positives from the American effort?
I believe we did a good thing by training the South Vietnamese Air Force unit. I believe we taught them well. I believe we taught them how to run an Air Force. And when I was over there, I even had the opportunity, and somebody say that to me, that they were awful glad we were there training them. So, yes, I think that from that standpoint, we may have done a good job as far as training is concerned and taking care of and helping them out and helping them so they weren't overrun by the Viet Cong.
What kind of lessons do you think this country should learn or should have or has learned from the conflict in Vietnam?
Well, Kelly, to be honest with you, that's hard to say at this point. My feeling has changed tremendously. My feeling is today, and I'm not sure this is answering your question, so I apologize for that. My feeling today is that we should fend for ourselves, take care of our own, and if you don't like what we do for you, then we won't do it for you anymore. And, my feeling is that we give away too much today. I'm not sure that the answer to exactly what you wanted to know, but
no, I think that it does. I think that's it's a very common kind of refrain from people who look back on it.
I think, it's time we take care of our own, in my mind. But who am I to say again?
Right. Okay. Well, Mr. Miles, is there anything else you would like to add to the record while we still have this interview going?
I remember, and Kelly, maybe you're going to get to this in a little bit or something, but I remember at the end of my 4 years, my I had an opportunity to reenlist, and we considered it very heavily of making a career in the military. And I had, a first sergeant that told me he would be sure he got me a stripe if I reenlisted. Went to the chaplain, and he checked, and he said, you'll be back in Vietnam in 6 months. And at the time, I was 72, at the time I couldn't, we were married and had one baby, and I just, the thought of that just was killing me.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want anything to do with that, so we didn't stay in the service, we got out.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Is that a decision that you've regretted or a decision you're pleased with?
Questioned in my own mind. My wife liked to travel, so that wasn't an issue, but I would not have liked to go back to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't mind. I could have stayed in the military. It was okay. And I think that I was good enough. I would have advanced rank-wise to make it worth our while. So it's a decision I questioned today,
mm-hmm.
if it was the right thing or not.
Sure, but it must have seemed at the time like it was the right decision with a new family.
Pardon me?
It must have seemed like the right decision at the time with
the
new family.
At the time it did, I think we both talked and we both agreed that it was the right thing to do. Kelly, may I interrupt you for half a second?
Sure.
Just a second. Thank you.
Go ahead, Pete.
Thank you, sir.
One of the things I can see is that you have, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, you can say what you want to. That's fine.
How would you say that you adjusted to life in the United States after your time in Vietnam?
I think I adjusted very well.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I have a business of my own. I went back to college when I got out. The first 6 months, I got a job that my father-in-law helped me get, and I was waiting to be accepted into college. I applied to college, and on a Friday, I got a not accepted. You are on a waiting list. On Monday, I got an acceptance letter.
Oh, very
nice.
So
it was that quick. So I went back to college, got my degree, worked evenings. Very fortunate that I got to work evenings for a company locally and went to work for them as soon as I got out of college. Worked for them 7 or 8 years, whatever, and then went to my partner here and I decided to hook up together, and I've been in this business ever since. So I think it's been very well. I've had an opportunity to go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to the museum. They retired one of my planes there from Vietnam, so Cindy and my wife and I went out and stayed and went to that ceremony. So I think in my mind I've adjusted well.
Very good. I can certainly attest to how busy your office is there. You're doing quite a business there by the sounds of it.
Jeez, it's just hectic sometimes. I tell the girls, you don't want to take a 3-day weekend or go away because the day before going is hectic and the day after you get back is even twice as hectic. So, but anyway.
All right. Well, I will, if there's nothing else you'd like to add, Mr. Miles, we'll go ahead and wrap this up then.
There is something I'd like
to
ask you.
Please
did
do.
Did you tell me there was some I did receive some forms in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
Did you tell me to sign them and send them back to you?
Sign one copy, please.
Okay, just one. There was two there.
Yes,
you
sir.
Only want one copy signed and sent back to you.